Welcome back to Eco Talk. I'm your host, Betsy Rosenberg, and we hope that you will find us to be your radio home for all things green. And all the news is not bad. Occasionally we get a great big victory, and that's what's going to be the focus of our conversation in this segment. And it's an important one, too. It happened in California, but as California goes, sometimes so goes the rest of the nation when it comes to environmental trends. So let's hope this one sticks. Well, a San Joaquin River here in California was for centuries a waterway so teeming with wildlife that back in the 1800s, farmers fed fresh salmon to their pigs. Imagine that. And I bet the pigs didn't ask if it was wild-caught or farm-raised. But it has been dry and lifeless for the past 50 years now. The Fryant Dam has diverted the river's natural aquatic riches to farmers throughout the Golden State. And now, after an 18-year court battle in what the LA Times has called the most ambitious restoration project in California's thirsty history, a landmark settlement has been reached to restore the San Joaquin River to its past glory. Joining us today is Jared Huffman, a senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council's Western Water Project, to tell us about this incredible, hard-fought achievement, which is the culmination of years of dedicated work by the NRDC, along with a coalition of 13 other environmental and fishing groups. So first, Mazel Tov.
Well, thank you, Betsy. We're very excited. We think that this settlement heralds a big and positive change for the state of California. The San Joaquin River is the second longest river in the state, but for the last 60 years, its Sierra snowmelt has not been allowed to reach the Delta. And the settlement is going to change that. It's going to restore flow continuity from the Sierra to the sea. It's going to bring back a historic salmon run that has been gone for six decades now. And we think there's going to be broad positive benefits for millions of people and for the environment as a result of this.
Where did the problems begin, I imagine, before 18 years ago?
Well, 18 years is just the lawsuit, but the problems really started back in the late 1940s when Fryant Dam was completed and became fully operational. And unlike just about any other major dam, Fryant left nothing in the river for the environment. It literally dewatered 60 miles of this great river. And the result of that was elimination of one of the largest salmon populations on the Pacific coast, and the southernmost Chinook salmon population on the continent.
Now, at one point in the litigation, a judge ruled that the federal government had actually drained the river illegally, resulting in the death of all the river salmon.
That's right. There is a statute under California law, Section 5937 of the Fish and Game Code, that requires all dams to release enough water to keep fish in good condition downstream. And it was that code provision that really became the heart of our litigation over the last 18 years.
I understand there was a rare broad bipartisan support for this settlement among a large group of agencies, stakeholders, and legislators. I suppose that really says something about how Californians, you know, want to live in relation to our natural ecosystems.
We think it does. When you look at the folks supporting this settlement from all over the state of California, including Republican legislators like George Radanovich, Senator Dianne Feinstein has been very instrumental, Senator Boxer, and also even beyond that, stakeholders like Southern California Water Agencies, the Bay Area business community. We've got a terrific coalition that sees the broad benefits of restoring this river and I think appreciates the way we've put this settlement together. It'll be a durable settlement that can work for not only the environment, but for the Fryant agricultural economy as well.
Now, a river that got to have, you know, that kind of problem where all the river salmon died, how do you restore something that was a precious natural resource to its early glory, as you say?
Well, under this settlement, the first 5 or 6 years are going to be spent doing physical improvements in the river because, as you mentioned, it's in pretty bad shape. It's been degraded and neglected for a long time. But we're going to start adding water within 6 years, and salmon will return. We're going to reintroduce two runs of salmon by December of 2012. And we may not recapture the full glory of the salmon runs that were so abundant that literally the farmers pitchforked them and fed them to the hogs, as you mentioned in the opening to this segment. But we will get a good, viable salmon run, I'm sure several thousand fish. And that's going to produce amazing benefits. It may be that we can rebuild it to the point where commercial and recreational fishing will once again be able to rely on these runs.
Now, the Frye Dam redirected water to farmers who use the water, of course, to irrigate, you know, their large agricultural, you know, expanses of land. Are we learning more about better, more sustainable ways to grow crops on a large scale?
We should be. We've certainly come a long way in the 60 years since Frye Dam was built and became fully operational. And we've got some of the best water managers in the world in this part of the San Joaquin Valley. They're very creative and resourceful. And they're going to bring that talent to bear on minimizing the disruption to their water supplies that could otherwise result from this restoration effort.
And, of course, we don't want to be too black and white here. We don't want to paint the farms and the farmers as the bad guys. You know, they're growing crops, so we have food to eat. What will happen to the farms under this ruling?
Well, that's, I think, one of the great things about this settlement is it's a win-win. It provides certainty and stability for the Fryant farmers who contract for their water from Fryant Dam. For the last 18 years, their water contracts have been under the cloud of litigation. And so they've been unable to tell their lenders and banks just exactly what their long-term water supply was going to be. This gives them certainty. It gives the river some water. It provides a commitment that some important restoration projects are going to take place in the river. There's really a lot here for both sides, and I have no doubt that the farm economy is going to continue very strong under this settlement.
And what lessons are there for people listening around other parts of the country who have similar issues?
Well, one of the lessons is to be patient. It took us 18 years to get here. And by some standards in California water disputes, that's par for the course. But another lesson, I think, is to look for ways to work together. Look for alliances and partnerships that might not at first be apparent. I think we came to realize, and in the Fryant interests as well, that working together, we could make this work in a much better way than if a court simply handed down a judgment that was beyond either party's control.
And over the 18 years, the climate, of course, for these kinds of issues is changing, although it seems like most recently especially. So are the currents, pardon the pun, of growing environmental consciousness helping to push things in the right direction or left direction or environmentally friendly direction?
I think that's helping. I think also, frankly, the terrible conditions in the Bay Delta are helping bring the issues relating to the San Joaquin River into the forefront of public consideration. You know, this is the most important estuary on the west coast of North or South America, and it's in a critical ecological freefall right now. It's got seemingly unsolvable water quality problems. The species are collapsing. And without its critical southern artery, the San Joaquin River, it's hard to imagine it getting better. So we think that in addition to the other benefits we've discussed here, we're going to be giving a very important infusion of life, really, to the Southern Delta at a time when it badly needs it.
A lot of dams were built around this country, of course, back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, into the 70s and beyond. What is the NRDC's position on dams now that we're seeing some of the, you know, downriver effects of them? They had some benefits, but obviously always with a cost.
Well, this case is not about taking out a dam. It's about bringing that dam into compliance with existing law. And other dams around the state have had to release water for fisheries. And the big fight in this particular case was whether Fryant Dam had to play by those same rules. We're bringing it into compliance with the Fish and Game Codes. We're not saying Fryant Dam has to be taken out. However, we are skeptical about major new dams in California. If you look at a map, we've already dammed and redammed, and sometimes even redammed beyond that, every major river. So remaining new surface storage proposals are often extremely costly. They provide very little water supply benefit, and we know that there are cheaper, more effective strategies out there that can get us to the same place. So, you know, we're not categorically against new dams if one could be shown that makes sense environmentally and financially, but the proposals that we've seen, frankly, don't make sense either financially or for the environment.
How important are these victories on morale, even just at the NRDC, not to mention just people who are concerned about these issues out there?
Well, I think this is a great success story, and it inspires people. I was just speaking to a group last night about the San Joaquin River and this long battle and where we have arrived in the last week. And it certainly, I think, gave them hope and optimism and a new energy to carry out their work on other rivers. I think we're making a statement here that if we can restore the San Joaquin River, we can really restore any river.
Thanks so much, Jared Huffman, a senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council. Go out and celebrate that hard-fought victory, and hopefully it will inspire people everywhere to say the power of one, whether it's a person, a community, an environmental organization, speak up. You're probably in the right, and let your voice be heard, because that's the only way we're going to make a difference. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Betsy.
And now it's time for a new feature on the new version of EcoTalk, the daily version, and that is going to be our nerdy book tip of the day. And today is green tip number 324. You can find it in the book. That is, you can also find a link to on our website. This is another reason to stop idling our cars, and that's that it's expensive. Idling for just 10 minutes a day can produce about a quarter of a ton of carbon dioxide emissions each year and can cost you at least $70 in wasted fuel. Also puts out a lot of particulate pollution. I have a cousin who lives in Chicago, and she called me last year and said, "Betsy, can you help me? It's so cold here in the winter, and all the moms sit there in their big SUVs while their kids are inside playing basketball, and they're idling their cars to keep the heat on, you know, for an hour at a time, and it's just so wasteful." She, of course, is Swedish-American, so she has that European environmentality, so I'm helping her work on that. And when we come back, speaking of cars, we'll be finding out about a new car that BMW is rolling out, the first hydrogen hybrid vehicle. Stay with us.